RA Exchange. Welcome to Resident Advisors Exchange. I'm your host and the Exchange's senior producer, Chloe Lula. What does it take to become a powerhouse female agent in the male-dominated electronic music industry? No one can answer this question better than Maria May, a name that might be familiar to anyone who's had a brush with big-ticket dance music in the past 30 years. May is a longtime agent at CAA, or Creative Artists Agency, one of the largest booking agencies in the world. She was hired a little over a decade ago to expand its representation of electronic music, back when the company saw that DJs were primed to become the new rock stars. May now looks after acts like David Guetta, who she's managed for more than 25 years, Paul Kalkbrenner, Marlon Hofstadt, and Sarah Landry. But don't be fooled. May is not just a fierce businesswoman. She's also a tireless advocate for equity and inclusion in club culture, and we spent a big part of this interview talking about how women are still underrepresented and misunderstood in today's music scene.
Maybe in the 90s, I was just extremely bright and very opinionated. And in the patriarchy, that's regarded as aggressive, when in fact I was just intelligent and smart and forthright and had great ideas. Yeah. And so I was kind of typecast or labeled as a fierce and aggressive, motivated person. But I think they were the words that people came up with when you had a woman who knew what she was doing and who did it very well.
In her conversation, she talks about the obstacles she's faced over the course of her career as she's actively rebuilt the rooms in which major decisions are made. She was first inspired by her involvement in Britain's illegal rave scene, which turned her onto the power of activism and showed her how on-the-ground organizing can lead to real-life policy change. I had the opportunity to interview May at this year's International Music Summit in Ibiza, where she was the first woman in the conference's history, more than 18 years, to win its capstone award. And we briefly discussed that in the opening of this interview. So, thanks so much for tuning in. Next up, Maria May. One thing that struck me in researching you for this interview is the fact that you seem to be very comfortable walking your own path. You stick to what you believe in regardless of the consequences. And on the IMS website, when they announced the award, you wrote, "The most meaningful work for me has been fighting the fight when no one else would or could or cared."
My peers that I met in my early 20s at nightclubs, who we were all young women who were extremely bright and very able, and we were trying to make our way in club scenes, and it was completely male dominated, and we needed to be really tough and hard to... All we wanted was responsibility, because we loved the dance floor, we loved the DJ world, it called us, and we wanted to be successful in it, and we wanted to be given more responsibility to do great things. There's many others in the list. Many, many others.
I mean, you mentioned that Judy was terrifying, but do you think that having that kind of fierceness is required of women still who want to make it in this industry?
I mean, everybody I meet, even to this day, comes up to me and is like, "You're terrifying." And I just don't ever think of myself in that way. And I think maybe in the 90s, I was just extremely bright and very opinionated. And in the patriarchy, that's regarded as aggressive, when in fact I was just intelligent and smart and forthright and had great ideas. Yeah. And so I was kind of typecast or labeled as a fierce and aggressive, motivated person. But I think they were the words that people came up with when you had a woman who knew what she was doing and who did it very well.
I know that you have fought very hard for women also to be paid better. Have you faced any obstacles in
this pursuit specifically, but also just in your pursuit of better representation for women in the industry more generally?
So on a personal level, I've always advocated for myself and I found it very hard to do it. But I always remember the words of an old boss, which was, you want to be an agent? I could employ you as an assistant. But if you're going to be an agent, you need to agent yourself. Old school advice. I can see him saying it now. But the reality was, I've always taken that with me in every negotiation. And I've always talked about in rooms on the women's panel about how we should all know our value. And we should not work for companies that don't offer equal representation, but equally offer us decent money, right? Because companies need smart and intelligent people, regardless of their gender.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you have to learn your value and you have to be strong about it. And you don't need to be arrogant with that. You can just be very clear. Mm. You might get labeled aggressive if you're a woman, but it's not, is it?
What would success look like for you in regards to equity and representation? Like, what would it look like if we were to get there as an industry?
More female headliners at festivals across the board. And I think we're starting to see it's starting to happen. I think we're starting to see this scene of artists slowly being more equally represented. It's taking a moment. I mean, if you look at the figures from the report, I think female artists have only gone up 1%. It's gone like up 1% every year. And sometimes I question those figures because I mean, doing the work that we do with Lady of the House, you know, kind of dispelling the myth. There's no female producers out there. And then we do an A&R competition and 3,500 people are sending great music, which we then release on the label and like kind of, you know, and they do really well. It's like trying to stop these analogies about all of that stuff. So yes, more representation across the board would be. And in terms of success, I mean, I've got two adult children now, just about to leave uni. So for me, just making sure that they're doing great in their lives. And that for me, having pulled off bringing up two children as a single mother by myself and this job, seeing how well-rounded and how hardworking and how kind they are, for me, that is success.
I mean, I totally stand behind everything you're doing, and I also really want more female representation in the music industry, also as a woman in the music industry. And I guess one thing I wonder is, you know, there's so many platforms and initiatives shining a light on female artists and Flinta artists, but do you ever fear that maybe they're ghettoizing women in the industry? Or I'm thinking a lot about like festivals at stages that have all women lineups, for example. And sometimes I wonder if that's like a tokenizing gesture rather than one that actually boosts equality.
I swing back and forth on this one. Mm. It's like sometimes I want to see a lineup of all women that are amazing playing on the same lineup in a safe space. Feel for people who've actually specifically gone to see women playing music. I don't have a problem with that. I do agree with you that there has been, till now, a bit of tokenism going on, where you often see the young female artists trying to break through, playing first on a lot of festivals. And I think that's a shame. But do you know what? At the same time, I think tokenism was a method in order to get this going. So I kind of came to the point was, you know, I never take no for an answer. So I'm trying to get my axe to break. I'm like, okay, we'll take the bloody slot and they'll smash it. And then you'll put them on a better slot next year. And so always the agent, always the pragmatist with that stuff. Mm. I do think that, you know, it's very easy if you're sitting with a male gaze to go, oh, not another bloody women's organization, or, oh no, not another female thing, or, oh, not another agent having a go at me about there not being enough diverse, bring it on. We wouldn't be having to do all of this stuff if the world was different. But I actually, I think tokenism can be a method, and I think it's worked very well for the last 5 years. And now what we need to push through is get the girls up higher across the board. Yeah.
You're not just involved in championing gender diversity, but in many other advocacy initiatives as well. So what are the causes that are closest to your heart?
Well, I'm on the Frankie Knuckles Foundation. I worked with Frankie for 17 years. I did a panel with Frederick, who runs the foundation, here last year. And I love all the work that they're doing in Chicago. There's a lot of work with AIDS patients, homeless, Black people, and also, you know, the initiatives that they get involved with here, then everywhere. I mean, it was a bigger effort, but saving the warehouse from demolition, where the word house music comes from, stuff like, so it's still standing, it's a lawyer's office, stuff like that. I'm really, really passionate about those things. I love bashing it, the government of the UK, as often as possible. And obviously the work that I did with NTIA during COVID was really, really good for me. We had no work coming in, and I was lucky enough to say, I need to fight the government to help our business. So I was working with NTIA, and we went for it. We were arguing with MPs, we were trying to raise money, we were raising awareness. It was fabulous. I love that stuff.
Well, I know that you have a background in kind of like a very rebellious background.
Yeah.
So maybe we can take a trip back there. You were enamored with the illegal rave scene when you were younger.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I had a boyfriend who was involved with a free party scene called World Party. And at the same time, I decided not to go to university and work for a big UK band called The Levellers. And they were travellers and part of the free party scene. So on one hand, at night, at the weekends, I was doing free raves, well, illegal raves. Then we had to go legal in order to survive because we were being shut down too much. But then on the other hand, I was working for a band called The Levellers, who were at the forefront of the traveller scene and were being squashed by society because they were different, had a different outlook on life, and because they were extremely popular and left-leaning. And the Criminal Justice Bill was brought in after quite a lot of legislation coming through. There was the Grain-Bright Bill in 92, which was about free raves. They were trying to stop them, and then they brought the Criminal Justice Bill in, which stopped the right to silence, which we don't have anymore, the right to gather, and no one in the country really knew about any what the legal ramifications. So the band said to me, because this was before mobile phones and the internet, by the way, said to me, right, how can we do this? So I think I was 19, and I figured out blagging free ads in the Melody Maker, free what they call billboards on roads, bus campaigns, leafleting at the gigs. That's how I met Caroline Prothero, actually. She was David Guetta's manager afterwards, but she was working at Ministry of Sound. And I remember jumping off the Levellers tour bus. In those days, I didn't wear shoes. Anyway, another story, another time. I walked into Ministry of Sound barefoot and asked to meet someone who was in charge. And I think I had like a sarong on. I remember Caroline coming out and was just like, oh, hi. But she was really kind to me. I told her what I was doing. And then she made everybody coming into Ministry of Sound sign the petition, because we thought doing a petition would stop the government. We didn't stop the government. Then there were marches that we were part of. And I got profiled in the Times and the Big Issue for kind of the campaign that I ran. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but it really gave me a taste for basically speaking up for issues when they need to be spoken up for, but also not being afraid to do it. If you know something's not right, say something. Artists have so much power and fan connection that if they're behind an issue, they can engage their audience. And it was a very early learning thing that I learned, that was how to engage your audience for, and not some, these days I feel like a lot of artists are scared to be, have opinions. And especially with the internet, obviously cancel culture is real. But in those days, it was all we had. And we battered the Tory government with that campaign. We gave them a little bit of a run for their money, and it was great to see what you could do with no money. Wow. As well, because we had no budget. They were a great bunch of guys as well. They were very, I wouldn't say virtuous, but they were very clear about what was right, what was wrong, how to treat people, to map what people look like. You know, in those days, they used to go into banks and people would refuse to serve them because they had dreadlocks and, you know, called crusties at the time or whatever. But, you know, it's like, you know, I was this kid that grew up in West London. I'd never met people like this before. So I learned a lot. And I also learned a lot about just not judging people by how they look ever. And it sounds as strange as it sounds, in 1990, it was a very good lesson.
Well, it's obviously something that's followed you throughout your career. And I find it really fascinating that you have found a way to push like a more activist political agenda from the vantage point of being an agent and more behind the scenes. So at what point did you decide that you wanted to be an agent? I know that for a while you were working as an assistant to a very successful agent, and that was kind of your entry point.
Well, as you sometimes do when you're young, I worked for the Levellers, and then we all decided we weren't going to work together anymore. And all my friends had been at uni. I regarded them as lazy because I'd had a job. And I thought I was going to have 6 months off. And then the Levellers agent took me out for lunch and said, "You know about dance music?" I was like, "Well, I go to a lot of free parties." And he's like, "No, you know about dance music." And he introduced me to David Levy, who's now at William Morris. And I'm sure a lot of people know this, but, you know, I worked with him for 17 years. Actually, I want to say he was my first male ally in this business. So they wanted to employ me as an assistant. They could not see that I should not be an assistant. I was a female, therefore I type, I do contracts, I make coffee. And he was the one that it took him probably 6 months to convince him that I was going to come in as a junior agent. And I think, even in my interview, they were not convinced. They're very old school, bless them, their hearts. And I kind of showed them the way. I've got many stories about that. But anyway, so he got me in as a booking agent. And he said, "Do you know Paul Oakenfold?" And I was like, "Yeah," because I was from London. "Yeah, he plays there." Didn't really know him, but I said I did. And he said, "Well, he's your first client." And so I spoke to Paul, best friends instantly, and, you know, learned how to be an agent, booking Paul Oakenfold as he basically exploded. And we did all sorts of things with him, like residencies at Cream, which no one had ever done before, billing, making him the headline billing, touring with U2. And we were kind of like doing all these amazing things. It was a unique moment in that time. There wasn't a lot of DJs. There were DJs, but there wasn't the business that we have now is so different from what it was like then.
Paul touring with U2 seems like maybe one of the first times that dance music was probably put in front of a mainstream audience. I'm assuming.
Yeah.
You eventually decided to leave and strike out on your own, which seems like a very symbolic and pivotal moment. So can you tell me about why you made that decision and what the biggest challenges were?
Well, actually, David went to William Morris and it suited him. And I was so happy for him. And I sort of stayed at ITB. And then I sort of realized that it was at the time where a lot of American agencies were trying to do business in the UK. And I started, you know, David Guetta, I'd sort of had a really strong run with Soulwax and Too Many DJs and Leon Bushwacker and all this like super cool stuff. And then David just started, you know, just shooting, like having hits. And I was working with Caroline on it. And I just felt he needed to be at an agency that reflected where he was going. And actually, after talking to a lot of the agencies, I chose CAA because I loved their culture. And I loved having a female boss, Emma Banks, who's amazing. I've loved every second of it. I'm 13 years in now, and it's been such a great experience for me there. They've just allowed me to just get on with it and thrive. It's been great. Very happy.
I have to, you know, before we started this interview, you mentioned to me that you have imposter syndrome. And I find it so surprising when you've clearly accomplished so much. You've grown the careers of people like David Guetta, who you've been with for like more than 20 years now.
25.
Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Getting this award is a lot. and, you know, being on the same lineup as like Underworld and Nile Rodgers and Sven Vath is just crazy. So maybe that's the fangirl. I don't know. I've always been taught that we're in the background in a sense, like, and the stars are the stars. And so it just feels, it feels like quite a lot to be in that list. But having taken counsel from my coven, if you like, I have decided being the youngest is pretty cool.
Yes.
And I'm not exactly young. And then being the first woman is amazing. And for that reason, I am doing this. because it's for all the women. I mean, it's finally, after all this time, we've got to this point where a woman is being recognized for her services to electronic music. And, you know, what if I'd said no? Who would have got it? Probably with another man, maybe. And couldn't let that happen. So I feel like it's a moment for all of us, really. I really honestly do. It's been a long time coming. And there, like I said in everything, there's been so many women before me that should have been recognized for what they've done for electronic music, for the business we have now. And so I'm taking it for all of them. I'm taking it for the team. It takes a village. Yeah.
We're all happy that you're doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You alluded to the fact that the music industry has changed so much. And I think we all know that. What do you think the role of an agent is now? I know in a recent interview, you made an observation that because of how quickly trends change these days with the advent of streaming and platforms like TikTok, it's more difficult to build a lasting fan base around an artist. And I am really, I'm curious what your, how do you navigate that?
Well, you've just got to take your time and not be in a rush. I mean, so many managers that we see and artists coming through, they just like want to be stars instantly. They want to like make as much money as possible, as fast as possible. And don't get me wrong, there is nothing wrong with that either. Mm-hmm. But if you want to be around 10, 20, 30 years later, you need to be confident in what you're doing. The people around you need to believe in what you're doing as an artist. And you need to take your time. The underplay, my favorite. So take an 18-month cycle to get to Brixton Academy. Why are you in such a rush? Like, build your connection with your audience. Take a moment. Think about how long it takes for people to find out things. It's not a day go by where you find out something new that's been around for 2 years. It's like, yes, even with the internet, even with social media, things are getting lost now. Mm. There's too much information. So the only thing that you can rely on really is what is real. And for me, that's what happens in nightclubs, interactions on dance floors, live shows, the energy at those, how people talk about them. And yes, I know people are spending thousands and thousands on boosting their social media now. And some of those acts are doing really well when they spend that kind of money.
Mm.
And I'm not going to knock it because it's a kind of mechanism of our business. But I do feel like some artists are getting lost in all of this. So let's go back to basics.
At what point did you start feeling a paradigm shift where artists and DJs started being treated more like Hollywood acts historically have been?
When agents like me started pushing them to the top of the bill and they were headliners.
Okay.
It's changed now, but obviously there was a period where we had a lot of promoters in the more contemporary festivals that just wouldn't put a DJ on as a headliner. So you're, as me as an agent was going, but my DJ, David Guetta, has sold 10 times more records than your rock and roll headliner, has got 50 times, stats. But the reality was, David for a long time was a bigger act than a lot of the headliners on the festivals, and we were being blocked by the festivals for a while, because there's a lot of old school promoters who just didn't want to put a DJ on their festivals as the headliner. They just couldn't get their hand around it. And now that has changed, because when you've got acts that are selling that many records, getting that many streams, earning that much money at festivals, providing that kind of show, selling out that far in advance. It takes a moment, but then I feel like this conversation is kind of like, I think it's changed so dramatically. Because I see when we sign some of the younger acts now, how early a lot of the major promoters are contacting us now, because they want to work with them from the outset, because they don't want to lose the opportunity. So I do think it has changed, because these artists deserve to be treated in that way, because of, and maybe not the ego side of it all, but certainly in terms of, you know, comparable success to major bands. Yeah, we've definitely got a lot of artists in our electronic world that are comparable to some of the biggest rock and roll acts in the world, if not bigger.
Yeah. And I have to ask, and I don't mean this in any kind of pointed way, but you come from such, you know, underground roots. You know, you fought for politics, didn't wear any shoes. Do you ever feel any kind of like cognitive dissonance in working with some acts who are so commercially successful and having
fun? I love a commercially successful act. What is wrong with everybody with this conversation? Can I just say, the minute you're on a private jet, you are not underground anymore. Okay, everyone? So the minute you're on a private jet, you are not underground. So this, I think my favorite analogy to this is, no, I don't have a problem with working with a really underground artist and a really commercially successful. In the words of David Guetta, I don't want to be credible, I want to be incredible, right? It's like, you know, I love the way our scene gets pissed off with people who make pop records. And, you know, sometimes people question whether they're even a DJ anymore. And to some respects, some of these artists are becoming kind of, you know, more like caricatures. You know, they're becoming sort of showmen of their scene with their shows. And yeah, it's not them playing to 500 people in a dark club with lasers at 4 a.m. No, it's not that, but that's that, and that's great. And what they're doing is also fantastic for the electronic music industry and for how we're growing our scene into the business and maintaining our business at the level that we are. So I think there's room for everybody. And I think there's a lot of hypocrites in the music scene. And I think we should be quite careful with it. I think there's room for everybody to express themselves however they choose.
What do you hope to achieve next? Like, are there any big milestones or goals?
Judy Weinstein said, it's all over now, you're a legend. So that phone call has stuck with me for the last few weeks. I'm like, oh gosh, maybe she's right. What do I do now? What do I do? I don't know. I'm kind of toying with getting a bit more political, actually.
Okay.
Maybe.
Do you ever fear that that might jeopardize your career in any way?
I don't think I could do both, sadly.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm too forthright and too opinionated. But certainly for now, what I'm really focused on is the clients that I represent. And, you know, we've got some major heavy hitter headliners, and then we've got some really cool up-and-coming acts. And I have an amazing team, there's Cal and Hugh here, some young agents from my office, and just bringing in people to our team and growing our team and trying to show people how to do business right, and continuing to grow our business and continue to provide excellent client service for all our clients. Is like, I still have an ego. I'm still very competitive. And I do, touching back on what you said, I do miss those days where I was that young agent and I was out in the clubs till 6 a.m. and hanging out with all the trendies or whatever. And there's a part of me that still wants to work with those artists as well. But I do think coming to a major agency is a statement of intent as well. So some of those acts in the underground scene, they're not quite ready for me yet.
Mm.
Not really, really us. But when they are, please, please give me a call.
As someone who's been in the industry for a long time, what do you think some of the greatest threats and some of the greatest opportunities are facing our ecosystem? Because I have found, even just having been at IMS for one day, that I hear very polarizing opinions about the state that the music industry is currently in.
It's true, isn't it? Like, if you look at anything in the UK press at the moment, nightclubs are closing five a penny. There's no one's making any money. No one's going out. Cost of living, da 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 da. And then I look at what we're doing as a team, and everything's selling out, and people are making money, and everyone's got a crew, and there's an ecosystem. But it would be a little bit kind of like not great of me to not acknowledge that there are people in the world generally at the moment. The cost of living is affecting a lot of people's ability to have fun, but also people to make money. So I do need to be aware of that. Maybe I'm just in a kind of lucky bubble, if you like, with the clients that we work with. Mm. Maybe. I mean, I think you make your luck, don't you? So there's another part of me. So on the flip side of that, it's just like, I do feel like a lot of the narrative is quite negative.
Yes.
And I also feel like the model that people keep going on about, the model from 1995, when all the clubs were full and everyone in England went out every weekend, is over. And we do have examples in the UK of some thriving businesses in electronic music, and they're trying their hardest to stay afloat and get the formula right to attract the customers. Mm. So as a hardcore business person, I'm like, I know it's harder. And I do know that ticket prices become apparent, and then we can talk about artist fees and all the rest of it. However, I do think that we still have a global business that is amazing. And considering I'm 30 years in, where we started to where we have now, we've got a lot to be positive about. We really do. And I think it's very easy to be negative. But how can we get young people to buy into our scene if all we're doing is moaning and complaining? Right? It's meant to be a joyful experience going out and engaging with each other and having fun.
Yes. Well, to end things on a positive note, who are you really excited by right now? Because I know that you especially have been trying to bring a lot of younger voices into your roster and like open the doors for a new generation of artists.
Well, I work with another agent on my team called Jen Hamill, and we've worked together for 13 years now, and she and I work on a lot of artists together, and we both signed Sarah Landry together. I think she's incredible, not only for what she does musically, but also her character, her brain. She's just a smart cookie and absolute pleasure to work with. And then a newer signing for us at the moment was Marlon Hofstadt and Maluji. And honestly, it makes my heart sing to work with clients like that. I'm getting emotional. Their approach to diversity and inclusion on every bill they get sent, they're fierce. That's what artists, you were asking me earlier, they lead with that. The lineups aren't diverse. They don't want to do it. Like all
another.
Right? It's just so great to work with people that kind of are doing the do. Makes me really happy to work with these kind of artists that really think and feel and act so naturally how it should be.
No, that's really great. I think that sometimes there's a perception in the underground that artists of the ilk that you work with are like very one-dimensional, and I actually wouldn't have even imagined that was part of their ethos.
Yeah, I mean, I think there needs to be more and more DJs that do this, because that's how we're going to make real change in this space. Mm. Yeah.
As a moderator, I have been asked to close with the following question. What wisdom would you pass on to those coming up behind you? How would you pass on the torch?
If you like the tune, as soon as you hear it, it's definitely good, right? Don't doubt yourself. If you can feel it in your body and you know you love it, don't listen to anybody else. If you love something and you can work with something that you love, then work with it. I've always been